Good afternoon and welcome back. By the way, coming up tomorrow, sports journalist and author John Eisenberg joins me to talk about his latest book here on Midday. It's called The League: How Five Rivals Created the NFL and Launched a Sports Empire. Plus, Marilyn Ness, the producer of a new movie about Baltimore called Charm City, joins me along with the community organizer Clayton Guyton, the founder of the Rose Street Community Center. That's coming up tomorrow on Midday. But now we turn to our good friend, Dr. Lena Nguyen. She has been a frequent guest on our program. She has served as the health commissioner of Baltimore City for most of the last 4 years. Her last day with the health department is Friday, and she's leaving to become the president of Planned Parenthood. For the last couple of years, Dr. Nguyen has been a regular guest on the Midday Health Watch. Lena, it's good to see you.
Nice to see you, and thank you for having me as a regular guest. I hope that I'll be able to return at some point.
Indeed. We've got lots to talk about when it comes to Planned Parenthood, but congratulations on this appointment. I mean, this is really a wonderful opportunity for you. We will miss you here in Baltimore, but this is really quite an opportunity. And it's interesting to me that you're the first physician in nearly 50 years to be named the head of Planned Parenthood. I mean, what do you think that means? What does that move mean on behalf of the board of Planned Parenthood who hired you?
Well, Planned Parenthood has been around for more than 100 years, and the founder, Margaret Sanger, was a nurse. Our mission has always been about providing care, no matter what. And the 2.5 million patients who walk through the doors of Planned Parenthood every year, that's what they are there for. And actually, this is why I'm coming to Planned Parenthood at this time, too, because when I look at the needs of public health around the country, there's one need that stands above all, which is we're facing a catastrophe when it comes to women's health. And in my role as the Baltimore City Health Commissioner, I've been seeing how women's health specifically is singled out, it's stigmatized, it's attacked, and that reproductive health in particular and women's health are seen somehow as separate. But we need to be affirming that reproductive healthcare, women's healthcare, is healthcare, and that health has to be a fundamental human right. So I've been thinking a lot this week and in the last several weeks about how I feel going to Planned Parenthood, which is an incredible opportunity to be able to work for an organization that's done more for women's health than any other. But I leave with a lot of mixed emotions because this has been my dream job to serve as the Baltimore City Health Commissioner. I work with such an incredibly dedicated, passionate team of public servants who are providing health care and who are fighting health disparities. And we've done so much in the last 4 years. I know that my team will continue to do exceptional work under Mayor Pugh's leadership. We've got hundreds of incredible women and men on the front lines making a difference every day for children, women, families, seniors, working on youth and health and wellness, on opioids, on so many other things that we've talked about on this show. And, you know, I'm very proud of my team, very sad to be leaving, but also recognizing that it's at this moment in history when I'm being called to step up and to fight with everything that I have. And it's my obligation to do that.
You've always talked about how the sort of core principle of public health is to go where the need is. We've talked on many occasions about the disparities, and you just alluded to them, where a kid born today in Harlem Park has a life expectancy 20 years less than the same kid to another kid born on the same day in Roland Park, you know, Federal Hill and Cherry Hill. It's the same thing. These are neighborhoods that are mere miles apart, but they are galaxies apart when it comes to access to health care, when it comes to health outcomes. As you look back on what you've been able to accomplish in these last 4 years, what are the big challenges moving ahead? Your successor, what's your advice to her or him about, you know, continuing to reduce these disparities?
I appreciate you bringing up the issue of disparities because, to me, that's the single biggest underlying problem for every health issue that we see. When we look at something like infant mortality, we have to see that back in 2009, an African-American baby born in Baltimore City was 5 times more likely to die than a white baby. Our overall rates for infant mortality were very high, but that one statistic about the disparity should be so shocking and call us to action, not only to improve health, but also specifically to cut disparities. And that's what we've been focusing on in my time here, that we've, in our Healthy Baltimore 2020 blueprint, we've said that everything has a health goal, but we're not only measuring overall health, we also have to specifically be measuring how we're doing with cutting disparities. So with infant mortality, our Be More for Healthy Babies Coalition, our partnership across our city, has reduced infant mortality by almost 40% in the last 7 years. And critically, we've also closed the disparity between Black and white infant mortality by more than 50%. That's the biggest challenge that's facing whoever is coming into this incredible opportunity next, which is that they have to see that every issue that we look at, let's take opioid addiction, we can look at it as we need to save lives. And we have been doing that because of my standing order, because of our outreach. We've saved nearly 3,000 lives in our city. We've started the stabilization center.
And to remind folks, the standing order, for example, means that anybody can get a prescription for naloxone.
That's
which
right.
You can intervene with somebody who's having an overdose.
That's right. It's a complete antidote to an opioid overdose and someone who would otherwise be dead will be walking and talking within minutes of getting naloxone, also called Narcan. I mean, 3,000 lives saved in the last 4 years. I also look at the fact that we've been increasing treatment, working with our hospitals now to implement standards for addiction treatment, becoming the only city in the country to do this, and starting our first of its kind stabilization center that's now getting traction across the state. I mean, I'm proud of the work that we've done, but all of these things are short-term solutions because one level behind the opioid addiction, we have to look at poverty. We have to look at structural racism, the culture of the war on drugs that's led to mass incarceration. And breaking that cycle and addressing these underlying disparities has to be my successor's number one priority, as it has been for me.
Dr. Lena Nguyen, her last day as the Health Commissioner of Baltimore City is Friday. She's leaving to become the president of Planned Parenthood, a position she will take up next month. We're going to have a quick break, and then we'll have more with Dr. Nguyen when we come back. Before we take that break, yesterday afternoon, following my conversation with the activist DeRay McKesson, I heard from Governor Larry Hogan's Director of Communications, Amelia Chassé. Mr. McKesson was critical of the governor's support of city schools. Ms. Chassé contended in an email to me that Mr. McKesson made false statements about the state's funding for Baltimore City Schools. She asserted that the Hogan administration has, quote, provided more funding for school construction and maintenance projects to Baltimore City than any other jurisdiction, tens of millions of which have been reverted due to fiscal mismanagement at North Avenue. Now, we have had several conversations here on Midday about the procurement and maintenance procedures in the city school system, a process which differs considerably from that in other jurisdictions. From 2009 to 2017, the system did, in fact, forfeit nearly $66 million in funds intended to make maintenance improvements, which school administrators said was often caused by delays in contracting companies to do the work under state regulations that the city was not able to satisfy. For example, many other counties pay for the work up front and get reimbursed by the state. The city does not have the available cash to do that. By the way, we have since last July invited the governor to be part of our series of conversations with the candidates. We have not received an answer to any of our requests. And if the governor's staff is listening, that invitation still stands. I'm Tom Hall. More with Dr. Lena Nguyen when we come back. Stay with us.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Now back to our conversation with Dr. Lena Nguyen, the outgoing health commissioner of Baltimore. She's leaving to become the president of Planned Parenthood. So, Lena, we talk about this all the time, the impact of several factors that affect your capacity to improve the health of people in Baltimore. Part of it is resources and resource allocation. Part of it is political will. Give us an overview now that you can sort of step back a little bit and take a look at it, having done it, been on the ground for 4 years, about both of those two factors mm-hmm. and how they have affected your capacity to do your work?
I think they're the same thing. Political will determines resource allocation. Whenever I hear people talking about the budget is a set of policy priorities. Where you put your money indicates what you think is important. Here in the Baltimore City Health Department, we've done so much with very little. We have been innovative and scrappy and also realized that we can't do the work alone. We've convened partners across our city, nonprofits, faith leaders, our other city and state agencies, so that we're aligned on a common mission. And that's how we've been able to move the needle on so many things. We do in the city what works. My single biggest frustration in these last 4 years as the health commissioner has been working with the state.
To working with the city itself, what the resource that the city's available or are willing to allocate.
Correct. I mean, yeah. I'm working with Mayor Rawlings Blake and then Mayor Pugh and our city council. They understand why the health of communities and why the health of Baltimore is so important. I can't tell you the number of emails, letters, phone calls, in-person meetings I have written or requested with various officials in our state government, in Governor Hogan's administration. We talk about what we know is already working. We talk about the dire need in Baltimore City and why a core principle in public health is to allocate resources to areas of greatest need. We do not get these resources. Governor Hogan and his spokespeople will, I'm sure, in response, give you many examples of how they have stepped up and helped us. And yes, they've helped us somewhat, but that amount is nowhere proportional to need and to the severity of the issues that we face. And they also do not take into account that we in the city already know what works. When we look at naloxone, the fact that we're rationing a life-saving antidote in the middle of a public health emergency, why is this happening? That budget and the lack of resources we get is an illustration of the governor's priorities. And I really worry about this. I mean, I hope that everyone sees that it is our leader's moral imperative to be serving those most in need. We are most in need here in Baltimore City. We already are doing what works. Why are we prevented from saving lives and helping with these deep structural issues? And to me, that's a question of political will. It's also a question of where someone's value system is.
And the governor's folks would probably contend that, you know, the state has indeed increased, for example, when it comes to the opioid crisis, the state has indeed increased funding for meeting the challenge of the opioid crisis. But you're saying that if the need is greater in the city of Baltimore, the funding to the city of Baltimore should be greater than it is to other jurisdictions in which the problem isn't as severe, simply because maybe the population isn't as big or for whatever reason they're not battling the same degree of difficulty, as it were.
I can't tell you, I can't count the number of requests that I made of the governor's office and the state of health in Maryland saying, here is what we need. If we had $10 million, this is what we could do. Here are the hundreds of lives that we could save, the thousands of people that we could get into treatment and help their families and help our communities. I mean, what is it that we owe to our city? Recognizing that these problems are there, but also the solutions are here as well. My frustration is that these funds that Governor Hogan claims are from the state, many of those funds are actually from the federal government. They're federal government funds that go to the state, and the state has to allocate to local jurisdictions. Now, my counterparts who are exceptional health officers across Maryland, they also need the funding too. So I'm not saying that they shouldn't get funding, but rather I'm saying that it's disingenuous to claim that this is new funding when it's actually not new funding from the state. And when there is so much that we should be doing, if this is truly a public health emergency, then show us where your commitment is and allow us to do on the ground what we know to be effective.
The governor would point, for example, to a bipartisan agreement with the legislature to address the decimation of the ACA by the federal government, by the Trump administration, by passing legislation here in Maryland that will help even the table a little bit, balance the playing field a little bit. What's your take on what the state is doing to help sustain the Affordable Care, the provisions of the Affordable Care Act?
I think the state and Governor Hogan have been very good about tinkering around the edges and helping with a few things that aren't harmful and may be helpful in some ways. But there is a lot more that we could be doing to ensure that everyone has health care in Maryland. There's a lot that we can be doing to stand up for reproductive rights and women's rights. Maryland has always been a leader, but right now we've been taking a back seat and holding still with status quo. We in the Baltimore City Health Department do not take a backseat to public health. That's why we have been leading on progressive legislation with our city council members, for example, on banning styrofoam, on ensuring that there is a healthy drink as part of every kid's meal, in getting past various pieces of legislation for opioids. I mean, there is so much proactive work that could be done in order to save lives. And I hope that that's something that all of our elected leaders will be doing.
Got a couple of phone calls, Dr. Nguyen. Let's hear from Herman in Waverly. Welcome to Midday with Dr. Lena Nguyen.
Thank you. Dr. Nguyen, congratulations on your new appointment. It's very exciting. My question is, how much of a problem is lead poisoning in Baltimore, and especially among young school-age children?
Thanks for that question, Herman. Lead poisoning is something that people have been worried about for decades now.
I completely agree. And Herman, I appreciate your thanks and also your important question. We have more than 80,000 children in Baltimore City who could be at risk for lead poisoning. And lead poisoning is something that leaves irreversible damage, irreversible brain damage that can impact the entire trajectory of a child's life. I mean, we're letting children be canaries in a coal mine where, you know, really what we do in the health department is we test children at ages 1 and 2 for lead poisoning. But if we're able to catch the lead poisoning early, then we're able to intervene and we're able to do home remediations and get landlords to comply. But we're still letting our children be lead poisoned in the first place. Now, we have, working with our partners, reduced the percentage of children with elevated blood lead levels by 95% in the last 15 years, which is very important, and I'm glad that we can celebrate that progress. But we still have tens of thousands of children whose entire futures could be affected. And that's something, this is another issue that really ties into the disparities and structural racism, another issue that the city alone cannot remediate, that we really require the state to come in with substantial funding, and not just rhetoric of why this is important, but funding to fund our programs that are already working.
When it comes to lead paint remediation, one would think that that's a pretty easy thing. You simply have public policy and statutes that say you are not allowed to own or rent a home that has lead paint that's going to expose anybody, children or anybody else, to lead poisoning. So, I mean, why aren't there statutes on the books, or are the statutes that are currently on the books simply not up to the task? Is enforcement the problem with the law, or is it that the statutes themselves are not sufficient?
So here in Baltimore, the major cause by far of childhood lead poisoning is peeling paint. In other cities, including Flint, most notably, the issue was lead in drinking water. That's not something that's a major concern in Baltimore. There are other sources of lead poisoning, too, which would include lead in dirt or lead in jewelry and other things that we do end up inspecting. From the perspective of the health department, we are able to do what we can at the point that someone comes in with lead poisoning. And then we can go after the landlords, and then we can go about remediation. But it would be wonderful if we can have programs that look at prevention, because that's what public health is about. Instead of waiting for that child to be lead poisoned for us to look at how we could have prevented them from doing it, why not start from the very beginning? And that's been that idea of prevention going upstream is a huge part of what we focused on in programs like getting glasses to all of our children, not waiting until the child has academic difficulty, but proactively saying, if up to 10,000 of our kids need something as basic as glasses, it's our moral imperative and our obligation to get them that basic intervention that can change the course of their lives.
Let's try to take another quick phone call from Lynn in Annapolis. Welcome to Midday with Dr. Nguyen. What's your quick question?
Hi, I want to thank you and Lena Nguyen for your service.
Thanks for tuning in.
Amazing human beings. Thank you both. And I want to say congratulations to Dr. Nguyen on her new job. And I don't know what you look like. I don't watch hardly any television. I haven't even owned a TV for 25 years. I watch it with friends and family, but it's very limited. I listened mostly to public radio. And I don't know what you look like, but I want to thank you because I have heard the genuineness in your voice for so long.
Okay, do you have a quick question for Dr. Nguyen?
I do. I just want to say I've been a huge supporter. I'm from Baltimore, and I've been a huge supporter of Planned Parenthood. I'm in my 60s. I went to Western High School. It's 497 women, all in their 60s, getting together, hopefully, next April for our 50th high school reunion.
And, Lynn, we're running out of time. What's your quick question?
I want to just make a suggestion. I remember well when Katharine Hepburn was the face of Planned Parenthood, and I recommend highly that you gather together a group of elder statesmen women, and with a sprinkling of men, I guess, also represent Planned Parenthood, the face of Planned Parenthood to our country, because
Thanks for that suggestion, Lynn. I appreciate it. I'm sorry to cut you off, but we are running out of time. The Kavanaugh hearings that happened over these last couple of weeks, I mean, the contentious climate that those were undertaken. There are people in Planned Parenthood quite worried that Roe v. Wade, as a matter of federal statute, will be overturned in a court that is now dominated by conservatives. What's your feeling about that?
Well, I'm a scientist, and so I'm going to give you the data and not just my own feelings about it. There are currently 13 court cases that are one step away from the Supreme Court. And given Kavanaugh's rulings before, given President Trump's litmus test for judicial nominees, it is very reasonable to expect that Roe versus Wade could be overturned or further eroded within a year, which is going to leave 25 million women of reproductive age, which is one-third of all the women of reproductive age in this country, living in a state that will ban or criminalize the legal right to safe abortions. And that's what's at stake. And when I think about what I've seen working in the ER, I've seen women die. I mean, we're talking about women's lives, people's lives that are at stake. And that's why where I need to be now is Planned Parenthood, because we are facing the fight of our lifetimes.
So that's job one for you then as the president of Planned Parenthood, to mobilize support for access to reproductive services like abortion?
Planned Parenthood has two focal points. One is providing access to health care, which would include the right to safe legal abortions, but also includes all of reproductive health care and women's health care. And the second is to fight to protect access to that care. That's what I've been doing my entire career. That's what I've been doing here at the Baltimore City Health Department. And I will be fighting with every last breath to do this at Planned Parenthood as well.
Well, Lena Nguyen, good luck and Godspeed. And we do look forward to having you back here on Midday to talk about the other issues involved with Planned Parenthood. Congratulations on the new gig.
Thank you.
Dr. Lena Nguyen, next month she will become the new president of Planned Parenthood. She is the first physician to lead the organization in nearly 50 years. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, John Eisenberg tells us about how the NFL rose from its very humble beginnings to become the major sports empire it is today. Plus, we're going to talk about a movie called Charm City with Clayton Guyton, an activist who founded the Rose Street Community Center and the producer of the movie, Marilyn Ness. We want to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. They've got locations and hours at joesquared.com. Thank you for listening. I'm Tom Hall. Have a great day. We'll